Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks by the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. In this episode of the Archive Project, Literary Arts presents a rare public appearance by one of Oregon's greatest entrepreneurs, Phil Knight, for the release of his 2016 memoir, Shoe Dog. In this candid memoir, Nike founder and CEO Phil Knight shares the inside story of the company's early days as an intrepid startup and its evolution into one of the world's most iconic brands. In 1962, fresh out of business school, Knight borrowed $50 from his father and created a company with a simple mission: import high-quality, low-cost athletic shoes from Japan. Selling the shoes from the trunk of his lime-green Plymouth Valiant, Knight grossed $8,000 in his first year. Today, Nike's annual sales top $30 billion, and the Nike swoosh has become one of the most ubiquitous and recognizable symbols in the world. But the man behind the swoosh has long remained a mystery. Now, for the first time, Knight tells his story, interviewed on stage by The New Yorker's Adam Gopnik. Hear firsthand from Knight as he shares his journey toward building one of the world's most iconic brands. Now, from 2016, here is Phil Knight interviewed by Adam Gopnik in front of a live audience at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall.
So, Phil, welcome to my house.
Yeah. Yeah. You're more at home here than I am.
I love being here at the Schnitzer. This is my third time within the past year of being able to speak here. Before we start talking about this really wonderful book, this wonderful American story, I have to ask you the thing that I've come all the way to demand, which is, why in all these years have you never asked me to endorse a Nike shoe? It seems to me, if you needed something, a short, non-athletic guy with very flat feet, I mean, there's got to be the Woody Allen, we could call it, something.
The Air Gopnik.
Air Gopnik.
Yeah, it's a certain ring, doesn't it? Yeah.
That's the price here. We've switched roles here a bit, Phil, because you are now an author.
Yeah.
Out on a book tour.
Yeah.
Something that I've spent a lot of time doing. What's it been like? What's your first feelings about being a book author?
Well, let me give you an example of what it's been like. Basically, this is the eighth draft. There were seven drafts before it. The first three or four drafts had a prologue. The next couple drafts had no prologue. On the seventh draft, decided a prologue, and in it, I had the following sentence. Us, some rare strain of pioneer spirit was discovered along that trail. I sent the prologue off to J.R. Moringer, who was editing for me before I got sent to the Scribner editor, and it came back, the sentence was changed to say this: us, some rare atavistic strain of pioneer spirit was discovered along that trail. And I'm going, I've never used the word atavistic in my entire life. So that is coming out, which it did. But then I went for a run. Well, it's not really a run. I used to run. Now I run so slow it's a walk. But I went for a walk and I came back. You know, atavistic is really kind of descriptive. Maybe I do like that word. So I put it back in. So I sent it off to my editor at Scribner, Shannon Welch, who was wonderful, this brightest young editor in New York. And she came back and she said, atavistic's got to go. She said, he says that we're not sending the reader to the dictionary on the first page, they'll never read the rest of it. So I said, that was fine with me. I was debated the thing anyway. But then they asked me to read the prologue for the audio, and which I agreed to do. And they sent the file out, and we have a sound booth at Nike, so I could read it there. And they put it on the teleprompter from what they sent out. And I go down in the morning to read it, and atavistic is back in. And so I'm going, well, Nan Graham must have overruled Shannon Welch, okay. But then I looked a little closer, and it wasn't atavistic at all. It was autistic. So I'm going, I'm not reading some rare autistic strain of pioneer spirit. So I read it atavistic for the audio. And I got done with that, and I went right up to my office, and I called Shannon Welch, and I says, you better make sure you didn't print 150,000 books with the word autistic pioneer spirit in there. And she called back in 30 minutes and said, we've checked all 390 pages. The word atavistic nor the word autistic is any of those 390 pages. So that's what it's like writing a book. But there were 390 pages of that to go. There was one other thing, and nobody told me the grind of the promotional tour. They didn't warn me on that. So I did 12 interviews in New York and Toronto in 4 days last week. And it was a bit of a grind, but there were a couple of really kind of rewarding moments. Darren Rovell for ESPN Radio can be a bit acerbic on occasion, but he said in the course of the interview, he said, I've read 200 business books, and he says, I've only cried at this one. And you'll never guess at what part I cried. And he said, it was when the Waddells, a hardworking family in Portland, gave their entire $8,000 to me as a loan to the company. And 7 years later, we converted it to stock, and it was worth $1.6 million. And Mrs. Waddell sat there in the kitchen and says, I don't understand it. I don't understand it. It was a meaningful moment to him, and also was a hugely meaningful moment to me. And the other one was with Robin Roberts on Good Morning America. She said in the course of the interview, which is shown, I think, she says, you know, I know how it ends, but he says, he's not going to make it. He's not going to make it. But she leaned over at one of the commercial breaks and she said, you know, I would have made a good butt face.
Well, we have to talk about what butt face
no,
is.
No, I'll be happy to, but I leaned back and said, you'd have been a great one. And those were kind of the two highlights of the interview
process.
Well,
I think you've had the core experience of being an author then, Phil, because it divides itself between feelings of being completely autistic and being caught in a completely atavistic activity at every moment. One of the things you'll discover now that you're out in a book tour is that every interviewer asks you exactly the same questions over and over again. Mr. Gopnik, why did you decide to write a novel about France, right? And you say, well, it's not really a novel and it's not really about France. But let me ask you a question that I suspect very few other people are going to begin your interview with. Mm-hmm. I'm almost sure.
I want you
to tell me before we talk about everything else in this book about your relationship with Ken Kesey. As a writer, this fascinates me. You were friends.
No, we weren't really friends. That we were at school at the same time, and so I knew him a little bit. But he was a unique guy, and the school was small. There was about 4,000 kids there, so most everybody knew everybody else. But he had walked off the football team because he was mad at the coach for starting a smaller guy ahead of him. He was about 6'1 and 200 pounds. So he said, I'm going to be a wrestler. So, but they had him wrestle 177 pounds, so he had trouble making the weight. So he was always out running, and I was always out running. And so we would wave, but that's about all. When he was there, he took a lot of writing courses, and I remember that he wrote a play, and I happened to go in through the student union one day, and the play that he wrote for the student body was on. And the play featured a main character. The star of the football team at that time was a kid named Dickie James, was running back. And the main character in Ken Kesey's play was Jamie Dixon, which, how creative is that? And the play was equally dreadful. Uh-huh. And so I went on then from there to go to Stanford Business School, and Brian Booth, who everybody here knows, I think, invited me over to lunch, and over to dinner at his house, and he said, you know, Kesey's here taking a writing class, writing a Stegner fellow from Wallace Stegner. And I said, oh man, he'll starve. And so it was 2 years later, and I was just finishing business school, and his book, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, was reviewed in Time magazine. And it had a huge review. And I said, wow. And so I went out and bought the book, and of course, it's really one of the great American novels of all time. But it has a sequel in that when we were in the running business, we were very much in the running business, we thought it was a good idea to start a running magazine, which didn't last very long, but we had the editor come over from Runner's World, Joe Henderson, who was kind of an iconic figure in the running community, and we decided to have great American authors write an essay for Running Magazine each month. And the first one was Hunter Thompson on running, which you can imagine.
I would think Hunter would have written about running away.
Well, no, it was I'm sure this will surprise you, it was really bizarre.
Good start. But,
so the second one, we had Ken Kesey write, and we had just gone to China to try to get things opened up, and we had another trip going over there, and we sent Kesey on the trip to write about the opening of China. And he came back, and he wrote his story, and it was about as equally dreadful as the play that he had written for the University of Oregon. China opening up, and he featured two things, trying to hit on the female translator and looking all over the countryside for Ming Wana. So those were my Ken Kesey stories.
The magazine didn't last very long.
And the magazine we did sell at a loss, about a year later. Yeah, but that was not Kesey's fault.
An all-star cast. Before we talk about the story you have to tell, Phil, what's a shoe dog?
Well, it probably has a lot of interpretations, but for me, the one I like, centuries ago, there were shoe dogs, which was a person that basically designed the shoe, made the shoe, sold the shoe, and he thought of himself kind of that he knew that the average person in his lifetime walked something like 275 million steps. So he thought his shoe, his production, was a part of that journey. It kind of connected him to humanity. I like that definition. It's also still used in the manufacturing world to say somebody that's really into manufacturing shoes. And it's also sometimes used as a synonym with sneakerheads, that those wonderful people out there that buy hundreds of pairs of shoes to put in their closet and on display as objects of art. And I wish there were way more of those shoe dogs.
But one of the things that's fascinating to me reading this book is that shoes, sneakers in particular, aren't really like any other product that gets made. They're intricate, they're shaped, they're artisanal in a way that very few other things are.
Yeah, they're not easy to make, actually. And the other thing is that there's no one shoe that's really perfect for everybody. Feet are like footprints, so what's a good shoe for you may not be a good shoe for me. So that's one of the reasons we have so many models, which was sort of tradition-breaking when we started doing all those models. But also, it is hard to make, that basically the temperature can change the pole on the shoe, and a complicated upper can have something like 18 different stitching positions. So it's not easy. It's really not easy to make a great shoe, which we try to do.
Right. Again, your story starts, of course, with your parents, but really the real eureka moment, in a sense, happens in 1962. Mm-hmm. For you. You have a big idea and you go on a big voyage. Mm-hmm. At that time. Mm-hmm. Tell everyone about what happened in 62.
When I go into the factory or just the...
When you go to... I was thinking particularly of your deciding that you wanted to do something important, that you go to Japan at that...
Yeah, well, I had written the paper for the entrepreneurship class at Stanford, and I presented it orally to the class, and they pretty much slept through it, but the... The professor liked it, and
it was
very
specifically about this idea.
This was the idea. It said that basically, why are all the leading sports shoes in the United States manufactured in Germany? It doesn't make any sense that would be a shoe manufacturing center. It said
Adidas and Puma
were the brands. So it made more sense to me that you could make shoes because it's labor intensive in Japan than in Germany. And Japan had certainly carved up the German camera market at that time, so it seemed logical to me that shoes would be next, or could be one of the next things. So I went to my father and told him about that idea, and also that before I went to work for 40 years, I thought it would be a great part of my education to go on around the world. And I thought that would probably fall on deaf ears, like a lot of my ideas with my father. But it was funny. He didn't really like the shoe idea so much, but it was the trip around the world was something that he always wished that he had done. So he accepted it right away, and so I was off and running. And when I got to the shoe factory in Japan, I went through sporting goods stores there and thought that probably the best made shoe was made by Onitsuka Company Limited in Kobe. So I went to Kobe and called them up, and they said, come on over. And I was pretty nervous, and I'm not a natural salesman, but I had to sell that day. And so I walked in the door, and before you get to the conference room, you had to go through the accounting department, which had like 20 accountants in there. And when I walked through the door, they all stood up and bowed. The big buyer from the USA, right?
And I thought, the national company.
I thought, I may not get out of here alive. But... we got around the conference room and we all were shoe dogs, and we started talking about that they'd had the idea to export shoes to the U.S. and were looking for a way to do it, and said they'd be happy to sell to me, and that I ordered $50 worth of samples on the spot and told my father to send him $50, which he did. And that's where it began.
And a lot of the book is about your relations with Japan, with the Japanese. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that fascinated me is that simultaneously with your having this big idea about making shoes in Japan and selling them here, you were fascinated by the spiritual life of Japan as well.
Yeah, when I went to Japan the first time, that I'd been in one other foreign country, Canada, And so it
we don't think of it as a foreign country.
No,
we're native to it, right?
It was kind of that I hadn't been around that much is the point. That, so it was really a foreign country, and so it was jarring at first for me. But after a couple of days, I began to really begin to like it, and I've actually grown to love the place, and have enjoyed going back ever since. Then I've been, you know, I don't know, 1,500 times, but.
Truly, 1,500 times.
No, 50 or 100.
1,500 times. So
or
I would buy a 1,500 from
Well, it's sometimes it seemed like that many, but I liked everything about it. I liked the countryside. I liked the people. I liked their sense, the spirituality. I liked the sense that in a period in maybe the world's most chaotic city, Tokyo, they get to find these little places of peace. That in their offices, they'd sometimes have a little shrine or a little tiny garden. And that carries through really to Nike somewhat to this day. The other thing, of course, I liked when I got to know the Japanese companies a little bit, they really had a kind of a spirit of teamwork. And so if you go out to Nike today, I mean, a lot of the interior has some of those light woods and some of the shoji screen doors. And there's a Japanese influence you know, about Nike. And I know in the early days, some guys would be kind of pissed off at me for some of the decisions I'd make. Well, you can't understand him. He's half Japanese anyway.
but particularly, too, you're drawn to the idea of not always thinking logically.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, that the whole culture, it had an impact on me. And sometimes you don't think in straight lines.
Right. You think sideways is more effective than forward. Was that the same trip in 62 when you went to an auspicious temple, an atavistic temple, one might almost say, at that point? Was that the same trip?
Yeah, well, that trip I went to a lot of temples, yeah, for sure.
But I was thinking one in Greece particularly.
Oh, yes. Then, okay. Well, I went to a lot of temples in Japan, too. But, then I went on around the world. And, of course, I went to the Parthenon in Greece, which was one of the things I was really looking forward to. And it was really one of the highlights of the trip. But, you know, just next to the Parthenon is the Temple of Nike, which was interesting to me at the time.
Goddess of victory.
Yes, the goddess of victory, which came back later.
And what a fascinating fact that I wasn't aware of is that what she did to get what in the play, in Aristophanes' play, what she's recorded as doing. She gets a shoe, she gives a gift of shoes.
She gives a gift of shoes, right.
She gives a gift of shoes.
It's there's a lot of interaction like that all the way through.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the book tells a story about building a company and building a business, sort of building two, first Blue Ribbon, the first one that you first did, and then on to Nike. One thing that fascinated me sort of globally in the book, Phil, is the whole notion of sneakers in American life. Mm-hmm. I had a great teacher myself, who was a curator, an art historian, and he said that the show he wanted to do more than anything else was a show about the American sneaker, because he couldn't think of anything that had diversified, evolved, changed, mutated as much in his lifetime as the sneaker had. Started off as the most stereotyped thing, and now has become this whole empire of objects. Were you aware of that as your life unfolded?
Yeah, we're exactly on plan. No, that it's startling to me in a lot of ways too, and it's and even to this day, we're focused primarily on making a product that can make the athlete perform better, and to the extent we've been successful, you've seen it get picked up and become an iconic object for the people in general, and that has really taken me by surprise. People. And I can now talk about that a lot, but it really has caught me by surprise. You know, it comes from the fact that I think that they're comfortable. We took a lesson when we got beat up in the marketplace a little bit because the shoes didn't look so good. So then we started concentrating on making them not only perform, but to make them look good. The design became an important part of our whole existence. And basically, you know, the public has bought it, and it's taken on kind of a different existence than we ever imagined.
I'm leaping ahead in the story a bit, but it's an irresistible detail in this is the talking about design and the importance of design to Nike and to the object is the invention of the swoosh, probably the single most immediately identifiable logo in in the world. And it was tell how that came about. Carolyn Johnson was her name.
Carolyn Davidson.
Carolyn Davidson.
Yeah, that Well, she was a graphic arts student at Portland State, and I taught there for a couple of years. And while I was getting ready to go full time, we didn't have enough money to pay overhead. We could only play salesmen. She had, I had met her in the graphic arts department, and she was saying, I don't have enough money for a dress to go to the prom. And I says, well, we're trying to do some artwork, and maybe we can work something out. And so she started doing some stuff for us, and she charged us $2 an hour. She was still a student. And so when we said, when we made the switch from Tiger to Nike, we said, we got to have a side logo.
Tiger being the first company.
Yeah, and we were distributing Tiger shoes, and now we're going to have to come up with a new product because they sank our boat. And so that we had to have a name for the product, and we had to have a logo. And so we asked her to go to work on a logo and try and connote speed and something that would look good on the side of a shoe. And she came back with several different designs, and we got together and changed it and modified it. And then we finally came up with is known as the swoosh. And she'd spent 17 and a half hours working on it, so we paid her the $35, which is maybe the greatest value in the history of business.
Now, I wanted to ask you, Phil.
But no, I got to give you the postscript, because
right,
we're not
please,
that mean.
I was waiting for it. But.
That when we went public, whatever it was, 7 years later, that we invited her out and gave her 500 shares of Nike stock. And to this day, she has not sold a single share, and they're worth over $1 million.
Oh, good. I'm glad. Because the reader's concerned reading it. And it wrote her a check for $35. And this thing, that's good to know. Let's go back. One of the things that's fascinating about, it's one of the things I know you emphasize about building a company is not just teamwork, but a team. Mm-hmm. Lincoln had a team of rivals, but mm-hmm. you really had kind of Dirty Dozen.
That's a good name for him.
A very original group of improbable guys to be building a great athletic company, on the surface at least. Would you tell us a bit about some of them? I'm thinking about Bowerman, Waddell. They're amazing characters.
And weren't they wonderful? They were wonderful. Yeah, I mean, I guess, yeah, it probably starts from Bowerman, who is maybe the world's greatest track coach, who insisted that he not be called coach. He didn't think he was a track coach so much as a professor of competitive response. And that was, I thought, a good way to look at it. And it, when you look back, he was serious that what he was trying to do was teach lessons that would help you, 20 years later. And a lot of people didn't like him because he was a stern disciplinarian, but most of them would come back 20 years later and say, you were really great. And he was kind of a mad scientist, too. He was always trying to invent things. He caught the East Grandstand on fire one time because he was stirring up a big tar pot of goo to try to make a synthetic runway for his long jump. And he was really the first guy to invent muscle tights. He basically used old men's long underwear and dyed it for cold days when we would run. And when we made muscle tights, then we made them out of different fabrics. But that's become a huge thing in not only the Nike line, but last weekend when I was in New York, it's almost a fashion statement again,
yes,
of itself.
Absolutely.
It seemed like every woman in New York was wearing a pair of muscle tights, which isn't that wonderful. it kind of started from him. And then we had Jeff Johnson, our first full-time employee, who I think is in the audience tonight. You kind of have to read the book to see how eccentric he is. He's probably the most prolific letter writer in the history of prolific letter writers.
He wrote so many letters.
He would write a letter in the morning and a letter in the afternoon. Before he had time to answer, he had three more. And then I remember I gave my sister Jeannie, she said, correspond with this guy. And she came back about 3 years, 3 days later, she said, you're not paying me enough.
It was Bowerman the one who came up with, when Adidas was it, who invented the Aztecs, who came up with the...
Yeah, we had a shoe when we for the Mexico Olympics in 1968 we named the Aztec. It was the first full cushion midsole running shoe, really. And we had high hopes for it, but we got a cease and desist letter, come on out, from Germany. So we're an international company now. They knew we were on the Mac and said, stop making this product called the Aztec. We have a shoe called the Azteca Gold for the Mexico Olympics. And so Barman and I were talking it, and he says, well, why don't you name it the Cortez? That's the guy that kicked the hell out of the, out of the Aztecs. And Yeah, and that shoe has been in the line for 40 years.
It's still is there too. And then another deeply moving personality who appears in the book is Waddell.
Bob Waddell. Bob Waddell was truly a key employee, that he had been an outstanding long jumper. He had won the dual meet with UCLA on a Saturday, and the following day he was out working on the canoe fate for Theta Chi, a tradition that they have at the University of Oregon. It was a big structure that they were trying to tack up and turn around, and it broke loose on the mooring, and one of the guys said, run, and all of them ran except Bob. And it crashed on him and broke his back, and which meant that he'd be paralyzed from the hips down for his whole life. And Barman called me about, I don't know, 3 or 4 months later, and he said, you know, Bob, thinking he might want to be a track coach, I don't think that's going to work too good. He says, maybe he could work in your company and our company. And so I met him for lunch and liked him immediately and hired him. It's one of the best things we ever did.
And you talked to about his attitude was always, don't you dare feel sorry for me.
Don't you dare feel sorry for me. That's right. And didn't take long. We didn't.
Easy man. You tell the story, though, about sometimes you would actually, because he was such a human being with such a tough core, but that you would sometimes become aware of how fragile he actually was.
Yeah. That he would he had complications related to that, and particularly with sores that... he would be hospitalized from time to time, but he'd come roaring back. Mm.
So you have this astonishing team, and then one of the things you were saying, Robin Roberts said she was worried you wouldn't make it through the book, in truth. One of the things I was thinking as I was reading it, Phil, is that in a way, just as a kind of case study of building a great business, it's fascinating because your sales and your capital are always struggling to keep up with each other throughout the book. Moments when you're selling extraordinarily well, you're still...
Our capital didn't come close.
But this is fascinating because when you're in sort of business school 101, right, mm-hmm. the more you sell, the more capital is, but it's much more kind of dynamic juggling and...
And particularly growing companies always have trouble with debt to equity ratios, particularly young growing companies. And it was further complicated for us than you had to put the money up before you got the shoes. It was a reverse leverage type of situation. You had to get to your credit line before they shipped the shoes. And so they were on the water. You're waiting, and the loan is going, and you haven't even got them to sell yet. So we were growing fast, but there was a huge pressure because of all the leverage.
Right. So there were times when you were selling off the shelves, but you still were worried about the survival of the company.
Yeah, no, it was, we were growing at a fast rate, but we were really relying on the bank to keep us afloat, and we would increase our equity by $50,000 and ask for $250,000 more loan. And after a while, they began to not like that so much.
A couple of the innovations that were breakthroughs for Nike and for the whole world of sports, the waffle sole, and the ballista, what you call it.
Yeah, there were two of the big ones. And obviously,
and both associated with particular inventors.
Yes, absolutely. That and it's obviously that those are the key things in Nike's history, which is, innovation is so terribly important to us. But we had just switched from Tiger to Nike, and Bowerman had been up on how we could get things going a little better. And we said that Waddell and I met with Barman and said, there hasn't been an innovative outer sole in running shoes in over 50 years. It's all that wavy pattern. It's just, and every shoe is the same. And so he nodded and he says, that is really true. And so driving back to Eugene, he thought about it for the 2 hours. And then the following morning was Sunday, and his wife made waffles for breakfast before she went off to church, and he's looking at that waffle iron, he's looking at the waffle iron, and says, that might be it. So the mad scientist that he has raw urethane in his garage, so he takes it in and says, we're going to try this, and he slaps it into the waffle iron, slaps the thing down there.
Into his wife's waffle iron.
Absolutely did, and it says that, but he forgot to put any kind of catalyst in there, and of course it stuck. And so his wife comes home from church, and she doesn't have a waffle iron anymore.
You don't have a soul, and she doesn't have a waffle iron. Yeah. Right.
But he then Bowerman, being the inventor that he is, he figures that, well, he can press those out on the lumber mill down at Georgia Pacific. And so he went down there and made the waffle pattern out of a mold and started making the first soles that we did on samples that we just made up at Jim the Shoe Doctor around Eugene. And that was the start of the waffle sole, which ultimately we then had made in production at the factory in Japan. And it's really what kind of put Nike on the map. We were growing a little bit and had gone into the black. First year we were in the red, but we're in the black, but we're just kind of stumbling along a little bit. But we came out with a waffle sole shoe and took off. What really got Nike going.
And then the next kind of booster.
Well, then when was it? Then about 5 years later, mm-hmm. We get this call from this man that claims he's a former engineer for Rockwell, and that he's invented this midsole that he thinks we ought to take a look at. And he said, sure, come on up. And so he came up, and it was a man called Frank Rudy, and he invented this air midsole, which he said gave greater cushioning and greater spring and greater bounce, and it had a lot of properties that you would want in a running shoe. And we looked at it, and it was kind of interesting looking, but we weren't sure. Basically, we scheduled a dinner with him about 2 hours later, and I went out for a 6-mile run, and it didn't really fit in my shoe, so it was pretty wobbly. But I came back after 6 miles and said, there's something to that. It had real cushion, it had real bounce, and so basically we made a deal within the next 24 hours, and you know, air is a key part of the line today, and has sold hundreds of millions of shoes.
But interesting thing, because it's something about building a business. It wasn't an instant hit. It didn't work the first time out.
Well, we were too smart for our own good. That basically we had the shoe made in the tailwind, which is the sole worked perfectly fine, but we decided to make for a really innovative and kind of exciting upper as well, and we made it out of a new fabric, and the fabric tore. So the soles worked perfectly fine, but the uppers ripped out. So that's not what you call a success. And we had to eat a lot of those shoes, but we were sold on the air, and obviously became a huge part of our line and a big part of our success.
You say in the book, one of the things that it taught you, though, is that innovation is great, but too much innovation at once.
Well, that's right. You only want one great innovation at a time.
And that built in there, too. Around that time, too, the Nike and you begin, and it's again, it's one of the themes of the book, to have relationships with athletes, mm-hmm. both as mm-hmm. official endorsers, but also personal relationships in terms of what they needed from Nike and what they needed from equipment. Many remarkable athletes come through in the pages, none more memorable than Steve Prefontaine,
right.
who is, I think, well-remembered here, but not necessarily as well-remembered in the rest of the country.
Yeah, that he's certainly well-remembered within Nike. That, you know, our first... Our first two endorsements, paid endorsements, were Jeff Petrie and Sidney Wicks of the Portland Trailblazers.
You paid them the big bucks too, didn't you?
Yeah, I don't know, maybe $10,000 or something like that. But Pre was getting ready for the Olympics, and he wasn't the least bit interested in changing shoes just before the Olympics.
But when the 72 Olympics.
It's the 72 Olympics, and he came back. From the 73, when he came back in 73, why we got him changed over, and actually he did some work for us, that going out to track meets and putting on clinics for the kids, and then Jeff Hollister would go with him and sell shoes. But he was probably, at least for me, maybe the most exciting distance runner of all time. It was just kind of the way he was and who he is, that most runners, distance runners have a tendency to be kind of shy, retiring types, and he was
very
outgoing.
They're running away from everybody,
right? Yeah, they ran away, and that's how they got that way. But Pre was a different type. That he would come out 30 minutes before the time, and he'd do a lap around Hayward Field, and he'd blow kisses to the crowd, and the crowd would roar. And I remember Jeff Johnson making the comment. He says, Prefontaine, 30 minutes before the race, is as loud as Ryan LeCurie were the last two laps of that famous mile. And it was really true. He would light the place up, and he ran in a dramatic style. He would lead, and he would just battle you. And he would just, as he often said many times, we'll go into the last lap and find out who's got the guts. And it was just hugely appealing, not only to people in Oregon, but really across the nation. And So, but I've often said, you know, Nike in their athlete endorsements has really got John McEnroe was the fire, and Michael Jordan was the heart, and Steve Prefontaine is the soul. He really was, and he still means something to this day. I mean, culture is a hugely important thing to Nike, and Steve Prefontaine is really a part of it. And so I can't overstate how important he was to the company.
But following up on what you were saying about how those three athletes played a role, we were talking earlier today, and I was struck by your sense that it isn't how many gold medals or how many Wimbledons, but that there are certain athletes who have a presence in the world, and those are the ones that are important to you and to the business.
Yeah, obviously winning is important. Charisma is a big part of it too, and there are all different kinds of that. One of the examples I used, Jack Nicklaus was the better golfer, but Arnold Palmer was always the better endorsement, and that's part of the business.
Right. Mm-hmm. But one of the touching things is that many of the athletes you've been involved with have become real friends, and you've been engaged with them.
What we said from the very beginning with Wicks and Petrie, and of course Pree, says we want to win their hearts as well as their feet, and I think that's been important to the company, and we've really tried to do that. Yes, they become like family. And so when they act up, we die a little bit with them. And when they succeed, it lifts everybody. And that's, I think, one of the things that's unique about Nike, that when we go to work on Monday morning and one of our athletes has performed at a high level, everybody in the company, from clerks all the way to the CEO, is lifted by that.
That's a nice thing. And some of them is you tell a moving story about Tiger Woods is always somebody who's always responsive, and you won't hear a bad word said about him.
Not from me, but you see it from a lot of people.
Let's talk. What's butt face?
Well, there was that moment. We used to have meetings, about every 6 months. We would go off campus to usually either Sun River or the Oregon coast, where you get away for 3 or 4 days and really think, because basically we were growing at a fast rate. We weren't a big company, but the rate was fast, so it would cause a lot of problems that you hadn't foreseen 6 months prior. So we would go and talk about the things that we had seen right and the things that we hadn't seen, and how we're going to correct it the next 6 months and how we'd go through it. But that in one of those meetings, but they would get loud. People felt very strongly about their opinions, and you had these, characters, which we've touched on a couple of them.
Some of them very big guys,
Del Hayes was, 300 pounds, and then Strasser came, he was even more. And Strasser, of course, might have been the loudest, though Hayes could be pretty loud, too. And they would come, one would come from production, one would come from marketing, and one would come from finance, and they would all have different sets of problems. And they would start out with, "You don't understand my problems," but getting them all out on the table was really very healthy, and we would get to some good solutions. But the yelling got pretty loud, and Jeff Johnson made the observation at one of the meetings. Somebody could stick their head in there and say, "Hey, buttface," and everybody at this company would look up and think they were talking to him. So then meetings became known as buttface meetings for 3 or 4 years. We don't call them that anymore, but they became that. And yeah, the buttfaces. Buttfaces really became a brand of band of brothers. That it was just a very, very close-knit group for a long time. Mm-hmm. And that was important, that just being bonded like that, I think, was very important when the problems came and even when the successes came.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that interests me as somebody who's a great lover of this part of the world is exactly what you're saying. You went, you didn't go off to Acapulco to have the butt face.
Right,
you
right,
stayed.
Right. Well, we didn't have enough money.
What if Nike had gone to New Jersey in 1973 mm-hmm. and had not stayed here mm-hmm. in Oregon, not stayed in the Portland area, how would it have been different? What about the culture of this part of the world, this state, this place, has contributed to the culture of
Nike? No, it would have been an entirely different company in almost any other state, certainly outside the Northwest. I mean, there is just certain Northwest type. And, Mark Parker graduated from Penn State, but he's now an Oregonian, and through and through. And I think that the culture just would have been a lot different. It isn't to say we couldn't be successful, but if we'd have been a Texas company or a New Jersey company or a Florida company or Ohio company, it would have had a lot different culture. And I think the culture at Nike is a huge part of why it's successful. And you know, it can always be modified a little bit and will be through the years, but I hope the main part of the culture is there 50 years from now.
Can you define, what is that culture?
Well, it's hard to define, isn't it? You know, I mean, a lot of people say, well, you created a culture. Well, it wasn't me that created it. I mean, basically, it kind of bubbles up from the people, and you can't dictate a culture. I've heard people say, we're going to change the culture of the company. Well, you better have a lobotomy. I mean, basically, it comes from within, really, and I've got fingerprints on the culture, but it's no means dictated by me. I've often said, you know, Nike is as a company, Nike is young and irreverent, and I'm neither. It's come from itself.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But it's like personality in an individual.
Informality, irreverence.
Yes, that's all in there.
Part of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And also another thing you emphasize here is growth is important too, that you'd rather grow than be cautious at any time.
Yes, it's very important, yes, that we're a growth company even when sales go down.
We're still growing. You're still growing. As companies grow and as they evolve and change, their crises happen and have happened to you. They've happened to you too. One, of course, that you talk about in the book is the question of manufacturing in the third world, manufacturing overseas. Mm-hmm. Criticism the company's gotten, hardly alone, but mm-hmm. that many American companies have gotten as they move overseas. You say in the book, and it fascinates me towards the end, that you're highly critical of your own response to some of that criticism mm-hmm. when you look back on it. What are you critical about in your own behavior, and how do you respond to that criticism today?
Well, I think, I was CEO for, 40-some years, and chairman and CEO for, 50-some years, chairman on top of that. But I made plenty of mistakes in that time, but one of them was the response to the initial criticisms about Nike factories. And that was almost 20 years ago now. But in the beauty of hindsight, I can say they were really kind of, the criticisms were really about the industry itself, and Nike being kind of the biggest took the brunt of it. But it angered me because we had worked so hard to get good factories. That's key. And I spent, after getting the finances straightened out a little bit, I spent a lot of time for the next 3 or 4 years maybe, you know, getting the right factories lined up. And the factories we had were certainly better than the Japanese factories that we had originally started with. And they were probably as good as any factories in the industry. They weren't as good as they should be. So
this is
that's what I should have said. But what I said was they're good factories. They're not bad factories. And it was sort of petulant and was not received well and wasn't successful. And we did a lot better when we finally came around and I came around saying, okay, say what you want to, but watch what we do going forward because we're going to make great factories. And we've worked on that ever since. I think one of the things we're most proud of during that period is that one of the most dangerous parts of a shoe factory was in the cementing of the shoe because the fumes off the cements were toxic. And so we said, we got to try to get rid of that. And our people came up with a water-based cement, which works just fine. A little scary when we first invented it and put it in a lot of shoes. I could see shoe soles falling off all across the country, but the water-based cements did work fine, and we shared that invention really with the industry, and most of the big companies use it now, so we're proud of that. And I think now, almost 20 years later, that within the industry, that we're recognized as sort of the gold standard for shoe and clothing factories, and many people have said so, and we put out an annual report on our corporate responsibility that explains, you know, how many of our factories are up to standards and how many have work to do and tell where the factories are. And I think there's probably no better evidence than the President of the United States to promote his TTP, his Trans-Pacific Trade Initiative, to promote it. He came out to Nike to do it, and he wouldn't have done that if he hadn't done his homework.
Mm. Terrific. And also, you talk here about the Girl Project, which is...
Yes. Came out of the institute. How can we be better citizens? And we work on that all the time. And we give a certain percentage of our net income every year to charities. And Maria Idle, who was vice president of corporate responsibility at the time, said, you know, we concentrate a lot in the United States, but we manufacture a lot of shoes abroad, and this poverty is a real problem abroad. And she said she studied it a lot, and she worked with Mike Spence, who was one of the endorsers of the book. Who said they came to the conclusion that essentially the poverty in a lot of these underdeveloped countries was due to the fact that the girls would get into marriage so early that they wouldn't go to school. They'd get married at 12, 13, 14. And then they wouldn't be able to support themselves, and the husband would leave them, and so they'd get into prostitution, and they'd have kids out of wedlock, and diseases, and AIDS, and all those things. And if there was a way to keep the girl in school till she was graduated from high school or something, the economic benefit and the morale benefit and the whole, you know, the feelings of the country would benefit enormously. So we started that, it's been 7, 8, maybe 10 years ago. I don't know, I've lost track. But it's having a wonderful effect, and basically that we've had huge donations from outside people, including the foundation that Warren Buffett's children have, and the government of England has invested money in. So we have broken the girl effect off out from under the Nike Foundation into its own standalone entity now, which has been able to raise a lot of money, and it's having a great impact in the third world, and we're very proud of it.
It's fantastic. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Books about being a shoe dog, books about sneakers, the books about building a business, books also about life, about yours, and a lot of it's about fathers and sons, your own relationship with your father, your complicated feelings about him, and also about your relationships with your own with your wife. And if I counted correctly, you and Penny are 2 years short of your golden anniversary. Is that right?
That's right.
Fantastic. Congratulations. He's here tonight. But you...
Who'd have thought?
But you talk in the book about your feelings of being torn often as a father and someone building a business, and that's something that still sort of exists inside you. I have the sense.
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, I'd say that writing the book was very beneficial for the way I look back on my own father. It was helpful. That now being a father myself, and I look back on him much more favorably than I did, while I was growing up, I think. I think every businessman or every kind of person that has a passion for his work is torn between the time you spend at work and the time you spend with your family. And, you know, when I go to these conferences, you talked about people about their lives, and I've never talked to a successful businessman who hasn't said that I wish I'd spent more time with my family. So it to some extent, yeah, I feel bad about it, but also it kind of comes with the territory.
Building a business and trying to do it too. As you describe very movingly in this book, you tragically lost your oldest son, Matthew, in a swimming accident. How did you cope with that kind of loss?
You know, it's funny because I don't really like talking about it, but when I wrote the book, I said I had to address it because you want to tell the highs and lows, and that was certainly the lowest of the lows. I got asked that question of the interview. I got a few times on the interviews that I just came from, and I said, "Well, it's in the book," and Penny says that is not a satisfactory answer. So if you're going to bring it up in the book, well, you got to talk about it. But yeah, I mean, no. Parent should have his child die before he or she does, and so it was devastating. That I got tons of letters. I got from almost every single Nike employee and from almost every single Nike endorser, and from people and strangers and people that we interacted with, and just in the business itself. But I got one letter that meant the most. Was a guy named Gordy Crawford, who was at the time recognized as probably one of the wisest men on Wall Street, and we had some dealings with him. And he wrote me a very personal letter that his own son had been 20 years old and a junior his junior and senior year at Yale. He had gone to Taiwan for the summer, and he had gone mountain climbing and fallen and died. And he said that when he got the news, he left the office and he didn't come back for 6 months. And it kind of allowed me to say, I'm not going to get over this right away, and I didn't. And both Penny and I had really trouble coping with it for a long, long time. But giving myself that 6 months helped. And after 6 months and 9 months, I found that I could function again. I couldn't function for a while, and I can function now, and I can laugh at a joke and all that. But the hole in the heart never leaves you. It never does. I can remember it was about a year ago. I was driving down the road past Glencoe High School, and there was a long, tall, young kid walking across the street, and he tripped and fell on the curb, and I had to pull over on the side of the road. But, you know, that Matt was always a sports fan, and he was always a little bit contrary. That we would watch games together, but if I was rooting for Georgetown, he was going to root for St. John's. And if I was rooting for Duke, he was going to root for North Carolina.
But never against University of Oregon.
But the University of Oregon is the one thing. If anybody liked Oregon better than me, it was probably him. And so he'd feel good that we named the basketball arena after him.
Thank you. I think we're probably... So we're going to give me a signal here, but I think we're at a moment. If you haven't filled out your card, would you do it now? Fill out your card if you have a question for Phil Knight. We'd love to have him. We'll collect it and go around. University of Oregon football team is a dear to your heart.
Sure.
Yeah, you can applaud. And that's something that's meant a lot to you. It's not something that comes in the book, but I should ask you, because it's very much has to do with your business. How do you feel about the concussion issue?
I think it's a problem, and I think they need more and more study because it is a violent game. And there's a lot of bad data coming through on the concussion issue. And I think more and more research all the time.
Is that the kind of thing? I know that you spend a lot of time at Nike. I had the pleasure of going up there for lunch day to the campus, which is a trip, as we used to say. A lot of time.
And New Yorker's view of the Northwest, right?
Spent a lot of time on design and talking about that too.
Yeah.
But you also spent a lot of time on biomechanics, right? Too.
You bet.
On doing better things. Is that an area in athletic design that you think is going to go on thinking about the concussion?
Absolutely. It's really kind of in its infancy.
Right.
And that's why I have hope on the concussion issue. That the science is growing very fast in all those areas.
Right. Thank you. All right, now here we have some questions from our listeners.
You're supposed
tonight.
To screen these.
What? No, I decided not to screen them. There's, malcontent employees, and there's all types here. I'll warn you in advance. And there's this one guy from Germany with a little Adidas stamp here. I don't know what that's about. Tell me more, if you would, Phil, someone asked, about your first trip to Japan in 1962. Where else did you go? You climbed a famous mountain, did you not?
64, I climbed Mount Fuji. But in the time since, I've been to kind of all the famous areas. I've been to Beppu and Atami and down through the Inland Sea. But the first time that it was just Tokyo and Kobe and then Kyoto and Nara, which is the old capital, which is a delightful place. All of those, you could take a day trip from the city of Osaka and go to Nara, which is one of the earlier capitals. It hasn't changed. It seemed like it hadn't changed. It was delightful. You sleep on the floor at a ryokan, and it's just a very, very pleasant, thought-provoking experience.
One of the themes of the book is the encounters of an American with Japan and Japanese culture, as we were saying before. And you paint a very complicated picture of it, because on the one hand, you clearly loved and admired so much of Japanese culture, but they could be rather difficult to negotiate with and to deal with.
Well, particularly in Nitsuka Company Limited, that basically cut us off. I love doing business with Japanese businessmen. That they had a certain style that was somewhat predictable, and once you knew it, you could deal with it, and it became a very interesting part of the puzzle in the game. That if they weren't sure they wanted to do something, they would drag negotiations on forever and ever. But they really wanted to do something, they could get it done in a hurry. I know it always bothered me for a long time that. We'd go into a meeting, and if you wanted your side to, have a meeting outside of their hearing, where you'd have to say, excuse me, you have to step outside and do it. And if they said, they spoke perfect English, and they'd say, excuse me, and then they'd speak to each other in Japanese, and you had no idea what they were talking about. So it seemed very unfair to me, so I had this brainwave that we're going to learn Japanese and not tell them. And so we were just about a year into Japanese lessons, and Tom Sumeragi, who is one of the heroes in Nike history and has said so in the book, I think, and that he sits to me and he says, She whispers over, they're picking up that you're picking up some of their language. So they've switched to old Japanese. I go, oh my God. Now I got to learn old Japanese? So that was kind of the end of the Japanese lessons.
But culture, coming back to your point, is terribly important to you. When the first time you went to China, you explained that you gave yourself a seminar in Chinese history before you went to negotiate.
That, not really true. We had a coach, David Chang, who had been born and raised there, and whose mother was very close to some of the power people in old China, which was very helpful. And he was a great guide, but I had never really studied much about the history of China, and that I thought the Long March was, USC 98 yards against Notre Dame. When I came back, that I really got immersed myself in it a little bit, and of course it's fascinating. Mm-hmm.
You tell the story too about David Chang was not the most diplomatic of people who have come through.
He was probably the preppiest Chinese man you've ever seen, with a bow tie and dressed in
Ralph Lauren.
Ralph Lauren all the way. But he just had an unusual style. But he was very helpful in those early days.
Getting started. We have so many questions. At first, I thought, oh my God, this is all we have. But now here's your real bounty here, and I'm sure there'll be. Well, let's try and talk about as many as we can. What would you tell, good question, a 19-year-old college freshman trying to figure out what to do in life? Advice. This is from Salima. And let me add something to that, because it interests me. You said a moment ago, or earlier this evening, you said you were not a good salesman.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, clearly you are a very good salesman when you have something.
Well, if it's life and death, maybe, it gets your attention.
Is that part of the answer, finding out what is life and death to you?
Yeah, I think so. That's right. Find what means something to you. And if you don't know at 19, you're lucky. Mm-hmm. I feel sorry for those people that know exactly what they want to be when they're 19 years old. That, part of the journey is finding out who and what you want to be between 19 and 30. And when you find it, go for it, with all you got. And, if you're a businessman, I mean, there's two things I think that I've learned. That one, first of all, you have to have a reason to succeed. You have to have a niche. In my case, it was Japan could beat Germany.
Right.
That was your big idea.
That
was kind of my
62.
Niche. Right. But then you have to have a passion, and you have to be prepared for failure. I had a wonderful professor of entrepreneurship, and he had a great expression that he said over and over. He said, "The only time you must not fail is the last time you try." That lived with me a lot. So I think that's a pretty good lesson. So, have a passion for what you do. And one of the things that sort of hit home in this last trip in New York, another thing that's important, have a spouse that believes. Greta Van Susteren asked Penny, she said, "Why did you stay with him?" Sort of pissed me off. But it was really true that she never didn't believe. So I never had that moment when I'd go home and says, "This existence is killing." I never had any of that whatsoever. She believed as strongly as I did, and that made everything helpful. So that's important too.
I was telling you the story the last time I was here and performing. My wife of 40 years was sitting right there in the front row and didn't crack a smile for an hour and a half. So we need a spouse in the front row to survive. But you also say something interesting in this book. You say that one of the worst advice you can give an entrepreneur is never quit. That there are moments when you have to.
Do it again. Start again.
Yeah.
The only time you must not fail is the last time.
Is the last time. How can, and somebody says here, "You rock, thanks for everything," which is pretty nice.
Can I have more questions like that, please?
And now here's the question. How should and how will Nike balance the irreverent spirit, the craziness, the butt-facedness of the company's history with this sophisticated $50 billion business? How is that possible?
That's the interesting part of the balance. I mean, basically, management is an art. It's a kind of a misunderstood and almost ignored art by the media to some extent, but that is the challenge that Mark Parker and his team has. And I believe they're up to it.
Fantastic. Oh, somebody asks, what was the runner-up to the swoosh logo, to the Nike swoosh logo?
Oh, no, that there were just other drawings that were kind of close, but not there. It was kind of a morphed version of the same.
But there was a runner-up to the Nike name, correct? That you weren't sold on Nike as a name until sort of the last possible moment.
You had to bring that up? we had 45 employees. They said, we're switching in a hurry, and we don't have time to really research this or pay for, and we didn't have any money for an advertising agency to look into it. So we just said, everybody put a name in a hat and we'll pick a name. And there were some really dreadful names in there.
Some of them yours, right?
Well, one of them was mine. But, you know, I mean, one of the suggestions was we just broken loose from Tiger, and one of the suggestions we name it Bengal. All the animals in the forest and the cobra and everything else were all in there. And so I wanted something different. So I said, you know, there's four dimensions and then there's a fifth dimension, so we'll make ours dimension six, which I thought was really brilliant, and nobody else did, fortunately. And so, yeah, that I was not creative enough to pick the right name, but I was had good enough judgment to discard it.
Well, you also mentioned, too, and I had never thought about it, that so many of the most memorable corporate names are one or two syllables with a K in them. Mm-hmm. Kleenex, yeah. Xerox, Kodak.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, Coke. Yeah, and that was Jeff Johnson.
Jeff Johnson noted
that and claimed that he thought of Nike in a dream. I'm not sure that part's right, but he gave us the name Nike, and we picked it.
Right.
And it's worked out pretty well.
And it had the nice overlap with the Temple of Nike.
That's right. I didn't even remember that. And then all of a sudden, years later, I said, hey, remember that.
And the gift of shoes and the goddess who gives shoes. Here's an interesting question. Who's the person who has been most influential on your life, and why?
Well, certainly my father, like most fathers, I think, but outside of my family, it would be Bill Bowerman without any question. That, I can feel him still.
And what was it about, you described Bowerman's, his character, his toughness, mm-hmm. his constant search for innovation, mm-hmm. I think so, and his persistent bad temper seems like three things that come in.
There's a wonderful story about Oregon was going to run the national championships in Texas, so the humidity was expected to be high. So he built a sauna in the next to the dressing room, and have his guys go in there and sauna after their workouts to try and hopefully acclimate a little bit. But Kenny Moore was in there in the sauna one day, and Bowerman came in with his keys, and Moore's just sitting there, and Bowerman takes one of his keys after he'd been in there for about 10 minutes and presses against Moore's thigh. And he says, damn, what did you do that for? And he says, you know the most important thing for a teacher to do? He says, what's that? He says, get the student's attention. But that was who he was. That was who he was. And that was important. He had unique ways of getting your attention, I'll tell you.
Someone asked, your son Travis, very successful. How do you advise him as a father and as a businessman? How do you play both those roles?
A little bit, and he listens to about 10% of what I say.
Oh, you're doing very well.
No, it was funny because when he graduated from Portland State with very, very high grades, and we talked and thought it was a good idea to go to graduate school in some field, but he had done well enough on all subjects, he wasn't sure what it was, so we let out a program where he would intern at a couple of different places before going on to graduate school. And the first place he picked was Will Vinton Studios, which is an animation studio here in Portland. And he never left. That he loved what he was doing. He says, this is what I want to do. And I thought, oh, my God. And but it reminded me a little bit of me going to my father and say, I want to sell shoes. So
you went to your father and said, I want to sell shoes. Your son came to you and said, I want to be a cartoon.
I want to be an animator. He says, animator, you know what they do? They sit there all day. And I say, how was your day? Oh, good. I got 5 seconds in the can. I go, holy cow.
I will tell you, my son, just is 21, just came to me and said, Dad, I'm having a difficult choice. I'll either be a classical guitarist or a philosopher. And you say, great choice, right? You're going to make a fortune either in either one of those two fields.
Right.
Exactly. Interesting question. We were up, I had the good fortune of being up at the campus today. And at one point I said to you, do you sometimes look around and not quite credit this? And you said to me, All the time. I sort of say, is this really happening still?
Right, right.
And someone asks then, do you prefer the Nike culture when it was an upstart company or as the enormous
Well, I like to think that the culture is being very similar, it's just bigger. It's more zeros on the sales and more employees. But it has changed. And for me, the most fun years were the early years. And a lot of people read the book and say, oh, that was just dreadful. And I said, it was so much fun. It really was. And every day you went to work and you knew what you did today mattered. And the adrenaline was there all the time. But I'm very proud that the culture has really remained pretty constant through the years. And I think that's extremely important.
And is that part of your role now as a kind of
I don't know. Maybe a little bit. But as I said, the culture is the culture. If somebody came in and mandated it would be something different, you'd get a rebellion.
Somebody went someplace else.
An organ transplant that didn't take.
Right.
And
somebody went someplace else and said, we need a Nike style culture.
That happens all the time. Uh-huh. And good luck.
Yeah. You need Nike style guys,
and it's been built up over almost 50 years now, 50 some years counting the Tiger years.
All right, this is the hardest question you're gonna get tonight, so be prepared. Stanford versus Oregon in the national championship, who do you root for?
Oregon.
All right. I'm gonna cut to the middle of the pack here to give other people. It's a good question. It's one of the things we've touched on when talking about the sweatshop issue and the third world and so on. Describe your growth of social consciousness alongside the growth of Nike. You've talked about how the company has evolved. How did you evolve as a person and as in your awareness?
Well, first of all, I've always believed that good companies are good citizens. I mean, that was actually a class in business school. It was always there. We had no means to give much back in the early years. The first year sales were $8,000. But, as we grew through the years, we've been able to do, a lot of good things. The girl effect is maybe the most outstanding thing, but we've been able to give back. We give, a certain percentage of the annual earnings. And the good news is things that changed me is that I've been lucky beyond imagination, and so I've started to give back in much bigger numbers and plan to keep doing so.
Here's a very specific kind of business question, but it's one that interests me. When did selling direct to consumer become a meaningful part of Nike's business? And more broadly, Phil, because a lot of the book is taken up with the whole business of getting shoes to stores for people to sell. And we're going through a bit of a revolution in that way, aren't we now, with online retailing and so on?
No question. No question. Online is changing retail enormously. That you see Amazon go roaring by Walmart. Who would have thought that? Yeah. But obviously, the person that asked it didn't pay total attention because we started out direct-to-consumer for those first $8,000 in sales for the first many years that we would go to sporting goods stores was who we were calling on, and they said, well, what the world doesn't need is another track shoe, and mm-hmm. So we said, okay, and then we'd go out to the teams.
Go
out to the teams and then we'd get a lot of sales, and finally after 4 or 5 years of that, sporting goods stores started calling us. There is sort of a revolution going on right now in retail, and you see most brands now have a wholesale side and a direct-to-consumer side in bricks and mortar, and then of course an online side. And that's a revolution going on, and I think clearly the online side of it is going to grow much, much faster than the other side.
Can you imagine in 10 to 20 years that there will be no retail stores?
I don't like to think of that. I still like trying shoes on.
You're a shoe dog.
Yeah, I'm a shoe dog, right. But I think, I don't know that the bricks and mortar stores will be greatly reduced, but I do think the online side of the business will be the one that grows by far the fastest.
Here's a question. Leadership is different from responsibility. Nike has a corporate responsibility group. But we have, in our factories, more than 10,000 workers only doing Nike product. What, in terms of leadership, can we do for them? So what's your take on corporate responsibility in that way?
Well, I don't know. I think I kind of touched on that already. You try to be good citizens in every area that you are. and that you want the jobs in the foreign factories to be the best jobs of any foreign factory there is. And the fortunate news is that most of it, well, certainly all of our shoe factories and most of our big apparel factories, you're dealing with partners in the broad sense of the world who are on that same page. And so you're working that on a team basis. When you're starting with a smaller factory that you're only doing a part of the business, it's harder to get them to cooperate and make those jobs for the people meaningful. But we try to be good citizens every place.
Is the robotic revolution going to upset things yet again? Do you imagine?
Yeah, there is a manufacturing revolution going on, and it's
not many people are aware of it, or necessarily. You
know. There's some guys from men. they work in that area at Nike.
Those are the ones that are the metallic men over there, right?
there is a manufacturing revolution going on, I think, across the board in every industry, and certainly in ours. And so you'll see the manufacturing process change in the next 10 years pretty dramatically in our industry.
Mm-hmm. Here's a good question. It speaks to the First Lady's concerns. With obesity and diabetes so prevalent in the U.S. today, can Nike help?
Yeah, we're active in that area. That's probably our biggest U.S. Charitable effort. And that's why Michelle Obama appeared on the stage with Mark Parker, the CEO, and why we work closely with them on that. And we're trying to get America moving again. Kids growing up today, it's a different deal. They got those handheld devices that are engrossing. And it's important. You know, obviously physical exercise is important. I mean, when you become an adult, and certainly before that, the habits are already ingrained. But the fitness, and in its most basic form, running, or for me, walking, that is
you
important.
You need a better shoe.
No, the shoes are just fine. But fitness is as important as eating and sleeping. And so if you don't start it at an early age, it's harder to learn later on.
It's a kind of contradiction, isn't it? We're a sports-crazy country, and yet we have a fitness crisis at the same time.
Yeah, it's sports-crazy from a spectator standpoint, not enough from an activity standpoint.
Is that one of the things Nike's tried to do, that is to fuel youth sport and those kinds
of... Yeah, we're very active in all those things. Mm-hmm.
Terrific. All right, I'm afraid we're running out of time, so let me ask you two questions that in a weird way are complementary and in another way define the sublime and ridiculous of your book and your life. The first question is, what is your favorite shoe you've ever made? And the other question is, what inspires you today when you wake up in the morning?
I don't know what the favorite shoes. I've had a lot of favorite over the years. Right now I'm exercising and I go on my walks with the Pegasus, which has been in the line for like 30 years. It fits my footprint really well, and I suppose you could say that's my current favorite. Nike still inspires me, that the hopes and dreams of that company. I think a businessman can be as much an artist as a writer or a painter, and obviously Nike is my best work and my art, and so it means still means the world to me, and I'll do what I can to help it as long as I'm breathing.
Terrific. Oh, I have one last question. I want to ask you, the book, tell me if you would, Phil, about the dedication to the book.
Yeah, I dedicated the book to my grandchildren. I have 6 biological grandchildren and 5 emotional grandchildren, so I count 11. And I didn't want them to grow up and not know who their grandfather was. And so I wanted them to read it in my words, not somebody else's words. And that was a big motivation for writing the book. And 4 of them are here in the front row tonight. Logan.
Stand up.
Dylan.
Stand up.
Willow and Ridley.
Stand up.
And. Without them, there might not have been a book. So thank you.
Phil, we've run out of time, but you have really made it worthwhile for this New Yorker with flat feet to come out to Portland and talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks. It was good. Thank you. Thanks.
That was Phil Knight, interviewed by Adam Goffman in front of a live audience at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in 2016. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear this or any other talk in the series, visit literary-arts.org. Crystal Liguori produces the Archive Project for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the literary arts staff, board, and community without whom this show would not be possible. Theme music for the Archive Project is by Emancipator. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.